Good morning and welcome to the Truth to Power Show on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, VJR Nathan, and our guest today is Tiffany Amber Modin, who is a 20-something-year-old New Yorker with a penchant for writing poetry on napkins and oversharing to strangers. After studying politics and writing at Pace University, she self-published her first book, A Lonely Trip Down the Rabbit Hole, in late November. Tiffany hopes to continue writing poetry about difficult topics and sharing with Uber drivers for the rest of her life, and has plans to continue writing and publishing books until she finally runs out of things to say, i.e. never. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So why don't we start a little bit with the genesis and the beginnings of a Lonely Trip Down the Rabbit Hole, and how did that book come about, and what was the impetus to be self-publish it?
Well, I started writing poetry when I was very young. And I gave it up for a while I was in high school. A bit of imposter syndrome. I felt like I wasn't good enough. But after high school, when I started suffering from a lot of depression and anxiety, I found that writing was sort of like a release valve for me. And if I could get feelings down onto paper, I could sort of almost then file them away and start new. So I started writing more and more poetry in a journal, and eventually I decided that a lot of the things that I was feeling might be things that other people my age are feeling too. So I started to put them on a poetry Instagram, which Instagram poetry is like an up-and-coming sort of medium for young poets. And I told myself that after a while, when people started to react positively, that when I wrote 100 poems, I would start to put a book together. And eventually I got to 100, and I did just that. I started to collect all of my poems, organize them in such a way that they told a story of what was basically a three-year period of my life. And it formed itself into a lonely trip down the rabbit hole.
Good, good. And if we could circle back also about the first poem, I believe in your book, you talk a little bit about the topic of your first poem. If you talk a little bit about kind of how your process evolved from that poem to today, you know, like you're talking about, I think you remember the first poem you wrote.
I Learned Early.
Yeah, I think also the first poem, MLK, I believe you
wrote.
Yeah.
When I was young.
Yeah.
Yes. When I was in first grade, I wrote a poem. We all had to write a little thing, I think, about Martin Luther King Jr. And I wrote this cute little poem that my teacher loved and ended up turning into a little song that we sang on Martin Luther King Day. And I won this little contest that she entered. And really just that... that feeling of pride that I felt was kind of the beginning of me wanting to be a writer and wanting to consider myself a writer and falling in love with writing and sharing writing with people. It was just such a great feeling to feel at six, like I had created something that meant something to other people.
Yeah, yeah. And then as you started to grow older, how did your topics or themes change, or how did you incorporate themes, or what would you say is your principal themes of your work?
Well, when I was younger, I definitely wrote mostly about love and heartbreak.
Uh-huh.
In high school, those were my principal feelings, I would say. I cared mostly about that romance. But in college, I really started to write about anxiety, and I finding different ways to sort of... to explain not only to other people, but to myself, what anxiety was that I was feeling. In the book, I often compare anxiety to a monster, that I go back and forth between feeling like the monster is a separate entity to feeling like it's a part of me. And that's something I'm not sure I've really figured out yet. But now I think I write a lot more about mental illness, and I write about abuse and sexual violence, things I've experienced, and the things that women in their of all ages really have experienced.
Yeah. And definitely finding pathways for healing and finding pathways to overcome or finding pathways to is a great way to introduce readers and through poetry to those pathways.
A lot of people suffer from these things in secret, and I've found that there's a strength to coming out and saying, this happened to me, or I feel this way, and then having other people say, that's happened to me too, I felt that way too, makes you feel so much less alone, and it's such a great and important part of the healing process.
So now we were talking a little bit about the philosophies and thought systems that influenced you. If you talk a little bit about kind of how your journey has been helped by or aided by different philosophical systems or religious systems, and how that kind of evolved over the years.
Sure. So, I mean, as far as philosophies go, a lot of my poetry is influenced by feminism and my connection to women and sisterhood, and activism, and you know, all of the important social issues that are going on. There's a section of my book that where a lot of the poetry is about that. But personally, I over the years have developed a belief. I've been studying Wicca because I think it is the closest thing to what I believe, and it is this oneness with nature and the universe, and this need to maintain a balance, because within me I've always felt this lack of balance, or this lack of emotional balance, mental balance, all part of suffering from mental illness. And you know, the people say when they go out into nature that they feel so much better, they feel so much lighter. There really is an energy in nature that can be harnessed and can be used to strengthen ourselves. And I've found that rather than looking to a god for strength, I find strength in the earth and the sky and all the life-giving forces. I compare women to Earth a lot because both give life. And to me, that's something that I worship, just the idea that I in a way, am almost a kindred spirit of the Earth itself.
Good, good. And in your book, you know, it's really great. You have some illustrations. You know, it's something that's very interesting to couple with the poems. So if you tell us a little bit about like kind of how those illustrations came about, who'd you work with? Or
so my illustrator is this local artist named Celeste Michaels. She's fantastic. She's traveled the world. She's extremely talented. I grew up with her, and I've watched her grow and flourish into this really abstract artist. And, you know, when I approached her to do the illustrations for the book, I said to her, you know, some of the other poetry books that were coming out around the time had sort of these like very flowery, light sort of pictures. And I said, you know, my poetry is more raw, and a lot of it is tense, and there's a lot of anger and emotion, and I really want the illustrations to reflect that. And then poems that were more about sensuality and the body, I want bodies. I want real bodies. And we decided to use this symbol of this red string. And on the cover of the book, the red string is connected to the girl's foot that is falling down the rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And throughout the book, there are illustrations where you see the red string, whether it's tied around an illustration or it flows through an illustration, but the string is kind of what always grounds the female that you see throughout the book, and eventually the string is what carries her back out of the rabbit hole.
Good, good. Thank you. It was very interesting. I think I captured that because I was reading through parts of the book and it really captured that aspect. So it was very good. So why don't we talk a little bit about your poetic influences and who you read growing up and now, you know, how they've influenced you and what schools of poetry do you follow?
So when I was younger and in school, We studied a lot of the classical poets like John Keats and Lord Byron and Walt Whitman, which their poetry is beautiful. And there's a reason why they are the most famous poets of all time. But I felt like a poet inside, but I also knew that my writing style was nothing like that, which was discouraging for a while. And then as I got older, I started to read more contemporary poetry. I should say E.E. Cummings was the first poet that I ever really loved because he broke rules as far as grammar goes and phrasing, which is something that I incorporate in my poetry. I love the way that he, in a way for him, he can convey so much and so little. And then Sylvia Plath was extremely important to me as I was coming of age because she wrote openly about her mental illness. And she wrote about her life the way that it really was and her struggles and feeling trapped. And Victoria Woolf as well. They were women who encouraged me to be honest. And then the contemporary poets that I love, there's one, her name is Olivia Gatwood, and she writes in the most honest, raw, almost the way she speaks because she does a lot of spoken word. Together, these poets that are more in the last 20 or 30 years have showed me that there isn't one way to write poetry. There's so many different ways, and I can write the way that I think or the way that I feel, and I can look at a page and use space and use phrasing and use and curse if I want to and say whatever to get my message across. And that's been so important. I think this movement that we've been experiencing of individualism and freedom and the angst that of the last 40 years has really kind of helped foster that feeling of freedom.
Yeah. And I know we were talking a little bit about education and how so important the importance of education, the importance of, poetry is something that sometimes is de-emphasized, and at least in my education,
yeah.
It's something that you have to kind of learn on your own, or if they do teach it, it's very kind of rudimentary and, it's not really emphasized. But I understand you had studied in undergraduate, you had studied some education policy, you focused a little bit on education policy, or interest of yours?
Yeah. I studied political science with a concentration on public policy, but my passion in that area has always lied in education. I strongly believe that education is the root of so many of our problems in this country, that if every child was able to receive in equal opportunities and equal education and It didn't matter where you live or how you grew up or what your race is, you still had access to the same information, the same true information, and we could send more people to college and encourage more people to follow their passions, to even develop a passion, that we would find so much less hate, because I really do think that hate is rooted in just the lack of education and being afraid of what you don't know. So I've always been a proponent of education reform and having a more emphasis on just having a country where we want our teachers to be the best. We want our students to be engaged. We want them to want to continue to learn. We don't want anyone to feel like school is not for them. I hate people who say, oh, school is just not for me, because the only reason that they feel that way is because right now school is only done one way. But if we expanded education to fit, rather than try and fit everybody into a box, if we just found a way to reach every individual like their brain mattered, then we would find a generation of people who want to learn and want to know more and want to read and write. And I think that if that were happening, we would have a much more peaceful and understanding society.
Yeah, I know that in education theory, they talk about like multiple intelligences and various theories like that that are just starting to become in the past few years, starting to become more prevalent and putting to practice. So it's something that had been de-emphasized earlier, but then You know, I think it was Einstein, I think, who had the quote, if the fish, if you judge a fish based on how it can climb a tree, you're kind of missing
exactly.
the point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not only students, but teachers as well. I mean, we give teachers a hard time in this country, but the reality is that in the countries where students do the best, like Finland, for example, you know, the teachers are revered at the same level as doctors, and they are educated to the max, and they become teachers because it's their passion. Whereas we have a lot of people who become teachers because other careers didn't work out for them.
And a
teacher like that is never going to go that extra mile to help a student who learns differently. I think it's so important that we treasure teachers and that we make them feel like they matter and that they are some of the most important people in the society because they are raising our children.
Yeah, definitely there's been in this country, there's a very big imbalance. You know, we spend billions and billions of dollars in defense and, and the military, whereas very little is invested in education comparatively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And very little research done into how to how to fix education and what needs to be done. And, you know, every time we try to do some sort of education reform, it's way too across the board. It doesn't take into effect like the regional differences around the country, you know, the economic differences between schools. It would be great if we could have one curriculum if every school were equal.
Yeah.
But the curriculum that works for a wealthy school in Westchester is not going to work for a school that has almost no budget in Queens.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it seems like we're afraid to take that big step to just sort of start all over again and figure out a new system, which I think is what needs to be done.
Yeah, and also it seems like they put so much emphasis on, you know, individuals have to navigate themselves and very much, you know, they too much emphasis, whereas they need the guide, they need that teacher to guide them through the process and help them and the students, I mean.
Exactly.
And yeah, we come to from a place where, you know, not everyone has the privilege of having a supportive, you know, family that encourages reading or something like that. Mm-hmm. So being able to do that through the education system is so important. And you know, the only reason why I think, you know, we have success rates in certain areas is that the family structure is so important.
Exactly. And I've always found it so unfair that two students who are equal in mind and equal in enthusiasm could have two completely different experiences because the public schools that they go to are so different in the opportunities that they offer. You know, one school might have a ton of AP classes and a ton of extracurriculars and can afford to hire better teachers. And then there could be a school that a town where I grew up, you could go 15 minutes. The next town over could have none of those things. And then when it comes time for college, you know, obviously the student that had more opportunities is going to look better on paper. And it doesn't take into consideration the fact that the student in the other school could be just as good, but was not as well prepared and didn't have access to all of those same opportunities and all excellent teaching and excellent material. And I just find that so unfair because most children don't get to choose. And it just feels like they don't have control over their own futures. And to me, that's such a mistake that we're making as a society.
Yeah. So this kind of ties into the question in the pre-interview question about if society were exactly as you imagine it, you know, what would it look like? What would it feel like? How would we act? What would we be? So, you know, I think that definitely there's something that talk about, you know, as individuals, we're trying to shape that society. We're trying to put out material. We're trying to connect with our communities. So tell us a little bit about how the society would look like, or if it was ideal.
I would love to see a society in which every individual person not only feels comfortable being who they are, but is given the space and the time and the freedom to develop who they are. I would love to see a society free of repression and oppression, and one where we are all able to contribute in our own way what our strengths are and what is best about us. I of course would love to see a society where we're tolerant and peaceful, where we can have conversations and exchange different ideas, and also a society in which we have a much greater appreciation for nature and for the world around us. And where we are, I feel like humanity is becoming more and more distant from Earth and from nature and grass and trees and mountains, and I would love to see a society in which we move back into appreciating what is around us that is free, that has just been, you know, given to us. Earth is such a gift, and I would love to see a society where we flourish on it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I definitely hear that you know, we're building more and more, separating ourselves from our natural environment. Mm-hmm. We're kind of creating structures that are more and more, not integrated, mm-hmm. not integrated as well as they could be. So, and as we start to create more and more problems with the natural world, it seems like we're destroying the very ground that we walk on.
Yeah.
So what about for you personally? What would be your ideal self, and what are you striving towards for yourself, and looking towards, or as we approach the new year, maybe any resolutions or any things that you want to work on?
Yeah, I am forever trying to achieve inner peace and balance. I am always either down, too high, or too angry, or too disconnected. And I would love to just find it in the internal equilibrium, where I feel at peace with myself, and I feel content with myself. I feel like I'm always, nothing is ever good enough for me. I'm always trying to do better, which is good, of course, to always be trying to do better and always trying to improve. But I feel like I am never just happy with who I am and what I have done so far and who I have become. And I would love to be able to look in the mirror and like who I am and feel proud of who I am. Yeah. That's something that I still struggle with. So that's something that I would like. I would like also to, and I think my New Year's resolution is to connect more with other people. I've always struggled with commitment and connection, human connection. I've kind of been a lone wolf, and, you know, I've been burned a lot. And I think that when enough people hurt you, you kind of develop that little wall around you. But I found that wall causes a lot of loneliness, a lonely trip down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So, my New Year's resolution is to rekindle relationships that I may have let go, and to develop new relationships. And just, I think the one thing that my life is missing right now is other people. And that's what I want right now more than anything, is to surround myself with love and friends.
Excellent goal. I think it's really great to strive towards, in self-care and self-achievement, self-fulfillment. Achieving that potential that we have inside of ourselves and trying to actualize that. So speaking of which, why don't we go to a couple of poems from your book?
Sure.
So why don't we, you can set them up as you'd like and read a few of the poems that are kind of representational of the book, so people to get a sense of it. Yeah.
Okay. So the first poem that I'm going to read, it kind of reflects a lot of what we were talking about, Earth and my feelings about women as life-giving forces and Earth as a life-giving force, and the way that I feel spiritually. And it's called God as a Woman. The truth is, God is a woman not so different from us, wild and wide-eyed with passion, a vision for eternal life born out of unity, guided by a dream she once had of love and lost in her desire to bestow upon us a gift, a fire in our hearts. She gave us the ecstasy of lust. But this divine goddess believed she must design her ideal companion before designing the image of her ideal self. And how could she know? Oh, it was only in hindsight that she was able to recognize the perfection in her own reflection, the wholeness of her femininity, and the kindred spirits that become of woman and earth when left undisturbed. But it was too late then, when she realized her true companion was the breath of nature all around her, the universe within her, the benevolent power of the mother. She had always been whole, never alone. And upon first glance at savage man, his madness in devouring her worth, enslaving her soul and eclipsing her essence, his fury in suppressing her purpose to distract from the absence of his own, she shook in agony. As man placed woman beneath him and asserted the right to her universe, tears rained from the goddess' grieving eyes, and the heart of woman was broken for the very first time.
Thank you, thank you.
Sure.
Very nice.
You want me to read another one?
Yeah, read another one.
I'll try and read a more positive one. okay. So this one is called We Are the Movement. And it is a reflection of my activist soul. I know it feels as though no one is listening. The world is crumbling and everyone's at home watching The Bachelor. I know. Day in and day out, your right to choose, your right to love, your right to live is debated by strangers who will never know your name. I know. But you are not alone in this. Your pain is shared by millions who are just as lost as you. Who can we trust when the odds are stacked against us? Your strength is admired, your resilience is treasured, and I promise you, Angel, we are in this together. We will defend you, protect you. When the world has turned its back on you, we will not give up on you. The road is long, I know. The wounds are fresh, I know. But we are a force to be reckoned with. And as long as you hold love in your heart, you can trust you are one of us, and we are the movement.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you, thank you.
Sure.
So yeah, I think I get themes of like the goddess and the feminine, and as well as the social, political.
Yeah.
And you know, in our previous one of our previous episodes, we talked a little bit about how, you know, femininity is long, you know, at least in the patriarchal society, it's kind of associated, kind of muted, and you know, pushed down. So the importance of resurgence of that.
Yeah.
And you know, in all beings, you know, men or women, being able to value you know, the feminine and not push it down, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah,
and redefining what femininity is. I have a poem in my book called Femininity, and it's written sort of like a dictionary sort of style of what is feminine. And, you know, it's like to be smart but not too smart, and you know, be, you know, sweet but not too sweet, and
yeah.
And you can never be, and I just think that we need to redefine what is feminine and what is not feminine there, because right now I feel like femininity is seen as lesser than masculinity. Things that are feminine are weak and fragile. And a woman's femininity is neither weak nor fragile. And you can be feminine and still be a feminist at the same time. And you can be not feminine at all and still be a woman. You know, there's so many different ways to be a woman. And just the ability to give life is not a woman's sole and most important purpose. It's a purpose that I think is beautiful. But even I'm not sure if I want to have children.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make me less of a woman, which I think is something, it's getting better now, but definitely during like the second wave of feminism, having children was seen as a woman's like prime duty.
Yeah.
And now it's just opening the world to give women all the same opportunities as men. And they may have them now, but I don't think in this country, at least, it may seem out on the outside as though we have all the same opportunities, but we are not shown the same respect, and we are not given the same path. Our path is much longer and much more difficult than a path that a man would take to the same end. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think our work needs to be done. Of course, in other countries, it's still so much harder, and there's still even more work that needs to be done. But that doesn't mean that here in the land of the free, we can't still be working on trying to make ourselves better.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think that, the attributes that are commonly referred to as masculine tend to be louder, and they tend to be more, and sometimes being louder or being
aggressive
and such. And these kinds of things are not always, even though you can hear them loudly, mm-hmm. Your soft voice sometimes can also be very powerful. And
yeah.
Being able to recognize that, that a roar is not always, the greatest thing in the world.
Speak softly, yeah, and carry a big stick.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And masculine qualities like loudness and confidence and aggression and those are all often associated with leadership qualities.
Yeah.
Where the quote unquote feminine character traits are not considered beneficial to become a leader. And I think that that's, first of all, so silly, because yeah. I don't think that there are character traits that you can ascribe to men or ascribe to women in general. There yeah. are men that speak softly and have no interest in leadership and feel insecure. And there are women who are loud and powerful and aggressive. Mm. And it's, that to me is such a silly concept, but I just think the lack of female leadership in the business world, in the political world, has to do with the fact that people are so trained to believe that a woman by nature is unfit to lead. Yeah. And I think that that is a thought process that needs to be completely flipped around, because it's been proven untrue.
Yeah, I think as society, we're starting to slowly get in the cusp of, undermining kind of how gender can express itself. And I mean, it's kind of undercurrent for a number of years, but now I'm starting to see more and more in public discourse that we're moving towards non-binary solutions.
Yeah.
And
it's a
and
spectrum.
Yeah, it's a spectrum.
Rather
yeah.
than it being this binary sort of you're this or you're this. We're finally allowing people the freedom to be this or this or anything in between.
Yeah, good. So also about what were some defining, we're talking about your own life and coming up to this mm-hmm. point of realization. If you talk a little bit more about the defining moments and some significant life events that maybe
sure.
helped mold you. Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of the life events that have molded me have not necessarily been positive.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think that in high school, I did a lot of theater, and being on stage, I think, gave me a sense of self-confidence and the comfort in front of people that would help me later. But really, I think what has molded me most and what has left such a great impact on me was I grew up the child of addicts,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of had to grow up kind of fast, and independence and self-sufficiency became big values to me. I wasn't taught traditional values. I mostly got those from books and movies, but growing up, taking care of myself a lot made me sort of the strong and independent person that I am today. And then, of course, there was a time where that was challenged. When I was 18, I unfortunately was in an abusive relationship. And that was an experience that sort of deconstructed my entire spirit and made me feel like I wasn't strong and that I was weak. And afterward, how could I let that happen to me? I thought I was supposed to be so strong, and I guess I'm not. And it has taken years for me to reconstruct my spirit and be the strong person that I always was and always have been. I just kind of lost my way for a while, but I think that experience was kind of my entry into adulthood. It was the first thing that I really experienced, like, on my own without family, you know, knowing anything about it. And I learned more than anything how to pick up red flags, how to speak up for myself. And now I write about abuse and about sexual violence and topics like that other people might shy away from. But I always say, if I can make one woman feel less alone, or if I can help one young woman see red flags before it's too late, then my experience will have been worth it.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I think when we think about developing our own inner strength and our own abilities and on our own, when we go off into the world and we're not necessarily under the guidance of our caregivers, you know, we're going off to college or going off to kind of embarking in the world, we think about strength training. You know, nobody would think about, you know, if a weight trainer were lifting up a large weight and feeling maxed out, you know, they don't give up. They keep going for larger and larger weights. So I think definitely in my mind, inner strength training is like that. You know, there's sometimes when we, you know, are challenged and we feel we can't do this, but then slowly we build up that ability to handle more complex and more subtle areas.
And you either sink or you float.
Sink or swim.
And I swam.
Yeah, good, good. And it's really great to think of it in that narrative that the story's not over until, you know, we gain that. It's not over until, you know, it's not a happy ending, then it's not over.
I really have felt like this book was sort of me closing that chapter of my life. Putting it all down into this book is me saying, okay, that period of my life, that pain that I felt, that challenge to my strength, that fall down the rabbit hole it's over now. It concludes. There is an epilogue, you know? And that means that it's over and it's time to start anew.
Good, good. So also, we were talking a little bit about, let's see, what are the topics coming up for you? Like, just talking about your writing practice, where are you going from now? What are you working on now? Where's the direction of your writing practice?
So I've already begun working on my second book. It's called Somewhere Close to Elsewhere. And it's a book composed entirely of poetry based on my dreams. And it really started because I would occasionally post these poems that I would write about my dreams, but they were very abstract. And I found that on their own, people weren't really getting them because they were kind of like, what does this mean? And, you know, and I realized that the best way for me to be able to write this poetry about my dreams is to have it all together in the context of everything you're about to read is a dream, is of something from my subconscious mind. And then I think it's a lot easier to to understand and to take in. And this book is going to be a little less heavy, a lot more ethereal, surreal, a lot more exploring the imagination. And then other than that, I've been starting to read a lot of plays. I just finished, and I should have read this years ago, but I just finished reading The Glass Menagerie and waiting for Godot. And I have started to read, I read a while back The Crucible and Streetcar Named Desire, and a bunch of I was in a bunch of Neil Simon plays when I was in high school. And I want to experiment with playwriting. I'd love to take a playwriting course because I do want to expand. Poetry is obviously my my main medium, but I really want to try and find a way to bring poetry to the stage. Sort of like, do you remember that film For Colored Girls?
I think I have heard of it.
It was this film. It was this beautiful film. And it was all of the dialogue, basically, I wish I could remember the poet's name, but the dialogue was all poetry for the most part. And it was based on this poet's work. And they would speak to each other in like these beautiful poetry. And I really want to experiment with writing dialogue and writing scenes that are expressed in a poetic manner.
Yeah, something so satisfying I think about with writing plays, because then you get a chance to involve other people and our community and having them perform it.
Yeah.
And it takes on a whole new life when it goes on stage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I also love, as someone who has acted and read a lot of books and is a film buff, I love characters.
Yeah.
Character development and creating. I've written some short stories and things like that, and I love creating characters and fleshing them out and making them unique but relatable. And that's something, you know, because my poetry, for the most part, you know, the speaker is me.
Mm.
But I would love to give voice to some other characters as well.
Yeah, I think that also in film and in theater, there's many avenues to this naturalistic, you know, where we follow a plot and follow a normal thing with, you know, a normal kind of representational reality, kind of mimicking how we interpret, how conventionally we interpret the reality. But there's also many avenues for the dreamlike interpretation in theater and film, where we're able to get alternative views on surrealistic or these kind of ethereal, all these kinds of aspects of the way of interpreting our lives, interpreting, giving alternatives to those things.
Having flawed narrators.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I think of surreal, I always think of, I was in Pippin in high school, which is one of the craziest, most surreal plays. But even, you know, The Glass Menagerie is a, what they call a dream or a memory play.
Memory play, yeah.
Which I have been reading about a lot, and I think is a fascinating way to tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so amazing how even in memory gets mixed into dreams and mixed into kind of almost like an alternative way of interpreting our lives or our memories.
Yeah, it's because, you know, when we remember things, we remember them, you know, what stood out to us might not be the same thing that stood out to someone else who experienced the same thing. Mm. And we choose to remember what was the most important part of that experience for us. So in a memory play, you know, what you see might not be exactly what happened.
Mm.
It's how the person who's telling the story interpreted and chose to remember that experience, which is just as important. Because all the past is are stories that we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, on a very technical level, I think that they call it an imprint that's left in your mental continuum.
Yeah.
So whatever experience we have, it leaves an imprint on our mind. And how those imprints form like almost like a color in our mental continuum that then colors our future experiences.
Absolutely. And when we associate colors and smells with certain things that from the past for what might be no reason, but there is a reason. It's just like a subconscious sort of thing. Yeah.
I remember I woke up this morning. I had a very strange dream that a spirit had haunted the apartment. It was haunting the apartment.
Oh my gosh.
And like the spirit had come down and was like a little upset about something. I was trying to be like negotiating with the spirit, because I was in the bed and I was trying to negotiate with the spirit, saying that, you know, I would maintain it, and just thinking about how it just made me reflect on how, you know, my own situation. I'm renting, and how you know, many people move through these apartments.
That's so interesting.
And how the basically like how this spirit had been lingering from previously.
See, this is why I am writing a book about my dreams. Because they dreams and dream interpretations can be so important to accessing emotions that might not be at the surface yet. But that you, thoughts and feelings that subconsciously you could be having. Dreams can be a really important source of information of getting to know yourself. For sure. So that's so crazy. I've been having a lot of dreams lately, people from my past coming back to me, which is how I know that, my New Year's resolution is that I need to reconnect with some people, because I keep having recurring dreams about the same people that I'm not in contact with anymore. And like, well, obviously my brain is telling me something. Maybe it's telling me I miss them.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, it's good to always strive towards community and try to connect and find, I think that dreams also like the, we think about our waking life and then our dream life as being the stark divide, but actually they're very interconnected. And, you know, we learn both about, we learn a lot about both from the other. And also, you know, in the very traditional Buddhist idea that, you know, if we accept the dream world as real, then we have to, if we accept the dream is unreal, we have to accept the waking world is unreal as well. That they're very intimately connected. So,
if reality is just, you know, our brains projecting something to us, then what makes the dream world any less real?
Exactly, exactly. Because there's always a dreamlike quality to waking world as well. That we interact with the independence of their own mind, how each experience is dependent upon our own imprints.
And hardly ever in dreams do we question the nature of the reality, even though it's not, even though it's only a dream. In that moment, we're usually fully confident that it's really happening until we wake up and realize that it wasn't. So who's to say that right now is not a dream?
Exactly. It definitely has a, you know, this dreamlike quality to it. The nature of reality is permeable or bendable, and that, you know, we're going to be everything we experience has a kind of plastic, as you call it, plastic.
And that's an idea that I definitely want to experiment with in my new book, is the nature of reality.
Good, good. Sure. So you'll be having a reading from A Lonely Trip Down the Rabbit Hole in January.
Yes.
If you tell us, if you announce a little bit about that. And
yeah. So it was originally supposed to be November 30th, which was the release date of the book. Unfortunately, it had to be rescheduled. Santa came down the street that night. So we had to reschedule. So now it's going to be the second weekend in January. And it's not only my release event where I will be reading poetry and talking about topics like domestic abuse and sexual violence and addiction and mental illness, et cetera. But we also we want it to be a celebration of art across multiple mediums. So I'll also be having live music. There, my illustrator will be selling big prints of some of the full-page illustrations in the book, as well as some of her own work. I guess there might be some other artists there. It's going to be a really beautiful experience. I'm hoping to really connect with some souls in the room and to have some of the people that come be able to relate to the music, to the poetry, to the artwork. And I want everybody to feel like they are a part of art and creativity. So I'm really, really excited for that event. And I'm really excited to finally present my book to, it's in my hometown.
Excellent.
So I'm really proud. A lot of people that I've grown up with who've known me since I was little, one of the performers that it's performing that evening was the host of one of the very first open mics I ever attended and has remained a good friend of mine over the years. So it's kind of a big deal to me to have the people that raised me, the village that raised me, to kind of be able to show them this is what I've done and brought back to you.
Excellent, excellent. So also in March, the last Thursday, actually in Forest Hills Library, Queens Library Forest Hills, we have a open mic and featured reader series every last Thursday of the month, but we'll be featuring you in March, the last Thursday of March. So anyone interested in hearing you or is an MMA January can make it in March.
Super
listen
exciting.
To you read from the book and talk a little bit about your experiences. So yeah, thank you so much. I will be winding down, but I just want to tell everyone that this is Radio Free Brooklyn, the Truth to Power show. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community and promote media literacy, education, and free expression. We rely primarily on donations from listeners like you. To help support our mission, we invite you to make a one-time donation or monthly pledge at radioforbrooklyn.org/donate. Every cent helps us continue to stay on air. So please support independent community media by pledging whatever you can afford. All contributions are tax deductible to the full extent of the law. Once again, that's radioforbrooklyn.org/donate. If you want to keep up with our programs and activities, please go to radioforbrooklyn.org/newsletter, and you can find out about things like the after-school program, which is going to be launching in 2019 to teach media literacy through media making using a hands-on approach guided by local professionals for local teens. If you'd be interested in participating or donating to this program, please go to radioforbrooklyn.org/afterschool. And remember, once again, that all donations are tax deductible. So, you know, I'm going to be playing a song leading us out. I saw the preview or the trailer for the movie Vice, which apparently is about Vice President Dick Cheney. So, and the song, though, was quite interesting and quite a good thing. It's The Killers. The Man. So I'll go out with that. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Baby, you're looking at the man. Who's the man?
minute. Take me stand.